Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent, and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, who's not here tonight, and me, Samuel Mann. I'm at Massey University in the office of Associate Professor Marianne Vandenbelt, who, among other things, is the Director of Ecological Economics Research New Zealand. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for the opportunity to be here with you today.
You've got a nice office overlooking
The
northern Manawatu.
I do. On a good day, you can see Mount Ruapehu and Mount Egmont in the distance, but not today.
But you didn't grow up here.
I did not. I grew up in the Netherlands. I was born in Rotterdam. I grew up in a town, a small town called Hoogvliet, close to Rotterdam, which is pretty much under the smokestacks of the Royal Dutch Shell refineries. So it was a place where air pollution, environmental issues was often, in our face, so to say, in our lungs, in our nostrils. I distinctly remember that.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
I think I very much early on became an environmental activist. The story goes when I was about 7 years old, I would rally my friends and we would spy, so to say, on people who would throw out ice cream wrappers or cigarette butts. And we would pick it up and follow them to their house and put it in their mailbox with a little handwritten note saying, "Would you please stop polluting our environment?" So the environmental activist, I suppose, or perhaps environmental terrorist, has always been part of me. I just like to think of it that my methods have become more refined over the years.
But perhaps less direct.
When I grew up, as I said, in a place that was, you could probably say, the wrong side of the tracks, my childhood hero very early on, even from the age of five, was Jacques Cousteau, who brought on TV those wonderful documentaries about the underwater world. And he very much became my inspiration. And
But you didn't become a marine biologist.
I did, actually. I'm very much a hybrid. I studied economics at Erasmus University because I figured out that the world's money and understanding money and money systems was very important if you wanted to understand the world. So off I went studying economics. And I call myself a survivor in that. And I understand, learn how to understand better how money, business in particular, works. And then I went to Sweden and I worked as an environmental economist at Vattenfall, which is Sweden's largest electricity and producer and distributor. A lot of hydro, a lot of nuclear power. And after a few years, I was made redundant. They got rid of about 30% of the company. And I started my own company. And that really gave me an opportunity to think much broader and think more in systems. So I picked up systems thinking, system dynamics quite a bit. I also picked up that it wasn't necessarily just about money and economics, but how different groups of people in society interact with each other and come together to collaborate on designing solutions that actually hold. And out of that, I've always had maintained that interest in marine systems. And I had an opportunity to do a PhD in Maryland, the University of Maryland in the United States, on marine estuarine environmental sciences. Yeah, so I went from an economist type of person to add that natural scientist perspective to it. And also Maryland offered the opportunity to wrap that in a certificate for ecological economics, because there were ecological economists there. My supervisor was Professor Herman Daly, who in the ecological economics world is very well known.
So Daly's approach to ecological economics is very, very well known, but you can perhaps explain it for us.
I didn't quite follow in his footsteps. Mm-hmm. I came up with a slightly different approach. But in essence, ecological economics is calling attention to three things. We're interested in ecological sustainability. Yeah, so the human system should be within the carrying capacity of the ecological system. Then we're interested in fairness of distribution. And then also, how do you think about efficient allocation of the resources? That's where it becomes slightly more economic. But it's not so much how do we use the existing economic tools on environmental issues. That would be environmental economics. Ecological economics, in my view, aims to design different and new type of tools that are not out there yet, so that we can answer those questions better. So it's a transdisciplinary field of inquiry. It doesn't want to be a particular discipline.
How many of those central premises were there in your original economics training?
None. And so that's where I had a bit of an issue. They would make me study microeconomics, right? Where supply and demand has to be in balance. And then the next hour you go to macroeconomics, where the system is supposed to be growing, especially GDP needs to be growing. And my question was always, how does that work on a finite planet? And I got absolutely no answer in my economics study. In early 90s, I think it was 93, I was working in Stockholm in Sweden, and that's where the International Society for Ecological Economics met, and that's where I found my tribe. Yeah. And there it was okay to think in systems, and there it was all about the limited substitutability between, you know, what people do, build capital and natural capital. So ecological economists think in four capitals. Natural capital, that is sort of the ecosystem, nature as, well, call it a production system. Sometimes people think that's a bad word. But really it's about getting that conversation about what's a healthy economy going. So we got natural capital, and as a subsystem within that is the human system, which is comprised of social capital, how we interact with each other, the type of agreements that we make, human capital, which is how do we solve complex issues, which requires you to be healthy, for example. It requires good institutions, governance, education, things like that. And then there's built capital, which is all the human artifacts that we put out there. Yeah, so those are your infrastructure, but it's also the technology, it's also, in my view, the money system. Yeah, so it's, those are our four capitals which give you production. So originally, an ecological economist is not particularly impressed with GDP, gross domestic product, because it basically measures economic activity only. It does not distinguish between whether that activity is desirable or undesirable, what we want it or we don't want it. For example, if we have sickness, if we have war, if we have disasters, that's all good for GDP. If we have crime, great for GDP. Yeah. Whereas the things that we do want, healthy families, low crime, working on environmental volunteering, for example, that is not taken up as valid activities in GDP. So you get a bit of a distorted picture when you take GDP as a proxy for well-being or wealth. There's even a discrepancy between activities, economic activities, you could say, or market-based activities locally that may be good for local communities but don't necessarily contribute much to GDP for the nation. Yeah, so there's all kinds of trade-offs within that. And so just focusing on the growth of GDP seems unhealthy to us. And Herman Daly is one of those people that argues for that we have entered into a phase of uneconomic growth. Yeah. So if you think of economic as the benefits outweigh the cost, then there are a lot of costs that we're not including, and perhaps a lot of benefits that we're also not including in our decision making. And then I'm thinking about benefits that we derive from the ecosystem that are not in our decision making. And that whole idea of thinking about the benefits that we derive from nature is called ecosystem services. That's a whole organizing framework. It's quite interesting.
Is New Zealand suffering from uneconomic growth?
I think it definitely should take a good look at that. Yeah, I think that we're blowing. We've got a lot of natural capital here. We're well endowed with our natural resources and ecosystems that provide people with benefits. But I think we're blowing through it very, very fast here. And just to give you an example, ecosystems such as forests or wetlands provide us with benefits such as erosion control, water purification, flood protection, things like that. Yes? Food production as well, cultural services. But anyway, if you look at the Manawatu here, 98% of the wetlands have disappeared. They have been tiled over and they're now agricultural land. 98%, that's a lot. Yeah. So if you consider that they function almost as the kidneys of your ecosystem, we might be in a bit of trouble. We might not be taking those benefits of those ecosystems into account in our decision making. And the same is true for forests. I don't have the numbers exact here, but I believe that up to 80% of those forests have disappeared. Yeah, and what is remaining is often managed for forestry. And if it isn't managed for forestry, it's often affected by pests and therefore not really functioning as a healthy ecosystem, therefore not necessarily giving us those benefits that we want from nature, such as flood protection, etc.
Why have we allowed ourselves to be blinkered to the holy grail of growth?
Well, I think it's a matter of, probably, if you go deep into it, it's a matter of worldview, how the world works. I think that the capitalist model has worked to a certain extent. And I'm not saying it's all wrong either, but it seems to me a system in overshoot. It's done what it does quite well. It has, GDP came in existence after the Second World War, Bretton Woods, where it was clear that in the reconstruction, economic activity was needed, and it was a good idea to account for it and measure it. But in a full world, as Herman Daly again calls it, a world full with human artifacts, perhaps, well, I'm almost certain, beyond its carrying capacity of carrying people in this particular way, is perhaps not the right measure. No, for certain, it's not the right measure to be focusing on. And we have to become more refined in our understanding of what an economy, a healthy economy, really is. And the problem is we're still often training economic students in that free market spirit. And if only we can include the externalities in our decision making, we're all sweet. The problem is, though, the goods and services from those ecosystems don't behave as marketable goods and services at all. And so just to say, oh, let's just include them as externalities isn't going to get us there, and we know that. And there are all kinds of feedback mechanisms that if you want to look at it, you will see it. But you have to take a systemic perspective.
So, right, I thought that if we could get the externalities into those sorts of modelling approaches, then would be sweet, but you're saying it's not.
I think that it will be very hard to account for all of those externalities, and we will never have all the science and all the evidence by looking in smaller and smaller pieces so that we have the right answer. Hence, I'm all for transdisciplinary approaches that are using synthesis, put the pieces together in an elegant way, and we know quite a bit about the system and what we really should be doing. And it's just a different way of doing science. I'm not saying don't do any analysis, but I think we really need to do more synthesis and train people and students in doing synthesis and putting the pieces together, not just taking it apart.
Do you have colleagues in the wider university that don't agree with ecological economics? Is there a purist view of economics that says, no, this is, there's something wrong with this?
I think, to be honest, tongue-in-cheek, many economists at the moment know the problems that economic theory poses because in practice it doesn't quite work. And they know that. But their whole careers are staked on publishing in a particular field, and you know, if you look at the funding streams, they are looking for that economic discipline. It comes with its own discourse. And having said that, there are a lot of different types of economists out there as well, from the very narrow neoclassical approaches all the way to, for example, Lynn Ostrom, who was the first woman to receive a Nobel Prize in economics in 2009. And she's all into the commons and how do we collaborate in that on making the economy fit into that natural capital. So she's all about working together. She's called an institutional economist. I hope I got that right. But she was also early on affiliated with the ecological economics networks.
When we ask people about growth, particularly politicians, they either say, growth's a good thing. Why would we not want to grow? Yep. And they equate it to human development, and point to all of the, that's their view of growth.
Yeah.
And in order to do that, then we have to have economic growth. And in order to do that, we're going to have the resource. Some of the more enlightened ones will talk about decoupling growth from resource consumption. Do you think that's possible?
I think we have to. The system's going to completely backfire And we're going to end up with scarcity in those benefits we get from nature. We're going to end up with scarcity in resources, and that is going to affect the social fabric of a society. You're going to have more of an inequality between poor and rich, because that trickling down of, okay, if we only grow, then people, yeah, they do get rich, and that will trickle down and lift up the poorer segments of society. It hasn't worked. And so and there's enough evidence out there that that doesn't work. The decoupling, yeah, if economic growth measured through GDP can be more economic development, where all the things that are desirable are calculated, accounted for as well, then by all means grow. But decouple it from the actual material throughput. That simply has to stop or reduce. And we see it in climate change, for example, the climate change goals. We do have to reduce the carbon emissions quite dramatically to stay within those global limits. And the same is true for almost any type of impact that we have on the environment.
But all of the political parties, with a couple of notable exceptions, still have as their number one priority growth. And it doesn't say growth brackets. And by the way, what we mean is decoupled. It's sort of like a headline that's easy for people to grasp.
Yes.
What can we do to get beyond that?
I don't know. I'm always surprised. I thought, personally, we've had this dialogue for decades now. And I hadn't even thought about it. But when I'm out there and I give talks and I mention it, it's still a revelation to people that economic activity, the GDP, only measures economic activity. It doesn't distinguish between desirable or not. And as a system, you know, I can go over it again. It doesn't work that way, really. And once the light bulb comes on, people go like, yeah, I get it. That's, you know, I understand that. But it is amazing to me how politicians can talk about it in such an un-nuanced way, as if that GDP is the proxy for everything good out there.
Are there alternatives?
I think so. For decades, we've experimented with various forms of, say, genuine progress indicators. That started with take GDP and subtract the undesirables and add the desirables, and you get a completely different picture. Then you see that while GDP in all countries, and this research has been done all over the world, you see countries' GDP growing, while the GPI, the genuine progress indicator, kind of levels off. And most Western countries, it levels off around the 1970s. I mean, that's one way of looking at it. It's not perfect either, because there are interlinkages between those elements of well-being, such as jobs, health, education. You know, there's a whole set of other well-being indicators out there. But when you look at them, they're interconnected, and we don't necessarily consider them as an interconnected system in decision-making. We tend to have, for example, Wellington uses GPIs, genuine progress indicators, and it has a set of about 83 of them. But there's no good way to interconnect them and think about the trade-offs between them and consider them as a system. That's really hard. And to me, that's where we really have to train the next generation of students in the synthesis of these things and thinking about it as a system to make better decisions.
So you're Director of Ecological Economics Research New Zealand.
Yes.
What work does that do?
The centre, you mean?
Or? Mm-hmm.
We have MB, National Funded Programs, have had to date. We Look, we use a whole set of tools. One of them, for example, was the Sustainable Pathways program, which is just finished. And we developed with some of the regional councils a toolbox on how to do this more systemically. So we use, for example, systems thinking, making causal loops with people. Yeah, so we bring people together, often from different departments or different stakeholder groups, and then we start to create a picture on how things hang together and how things might be changing over time. It's really a way to facilitate a complex dialogue between those people. And you can scale it up. You can then make that into more of a simulation model. That's where I call it mediated modeling. And we can scale that up again and use all the databases that are out there more effectively to create maps on how things change over time. And for example, you can, with the framework that we've built, you can assess the impacts of, for example, the rail loop in Auckland, or the building of a new convention center in Wellington, and over space and time, look at how things might be changing and play out different scenarios. And that's not prediction, eh? Systems thinking, system dynamics is not so much about prediction. It's more about understanding the system, because we will never, in my view, have all the evidence to know all of it. There's always another bend perspective that we don't have the exact evidence for. I mean, decisions are made all the time, and politicians make a lot of decisions, and not always on evidence based.
Because that's the nature of decisions, you are having to make decisions in imperfect information.
Exactly. Yeah, and so my view on that is, how do we make better decisions in a timely fashion? Yeah? How do we develop the capacity to make the best possible decision in the most transparent way? How do we synthesize the information we have effectively?
What's the core of systems thinking that you would like all decision makers to grasp?
Systems change over time. Yeah, so there's a change over time element, and systems are usually not linear. For example, if we have a problem with flood, what we tend to then do is build flood protection. Yes? And so that's where, in a linear way, it tends to stop as a conversation. Okay, so we build stop banks. But I'm saying the building of stop banks has the implication that people feel safe and therefore build more assets behind those stop banks, houses, businesses. If you build more assets, you pay tax, and with the tax, you build higher stop banks. Yeah? So you set up a reinforcing cycle, a feedback loop in that system. And at what point is that? In an overshoot situation, for example, in the Manawatu, about half of our regional budget goes to flood protection and river management. That's a lot. Instead, you could wonder, okay, can we do flood protection in a different way? For example, if we take better care of the steep hills and the forests that provide us with flood protection over time, same with the wetlands. Are those 2% in the Manawatu enough to provide the flood protection that we want? Perhaps rather than keep building flood protection in a build capital type of way, perhaps we should consider investing in natural capital, because natural capital provides those services that we want as well, but in a different way.
Why have we been so bad at teaching people to think in systems?
Oh gosh, you can take all kinds of approaches to that. I think it's an uncommon common sense. I think the linear way is more usual. It's more predictable. It's how disciplines are organized. We tend to like disciplinary thinking because it gives us the academic careers. I think it's part of, if you go back really a lot, the whole industrialization of going more and more in detail and specialisms. And we kind of forgot the art of synthesizing things back together. You tell me, it's my big quest, my big fight to bring disciplines together and focus more on synthesis and developing solutions rather than highlighting more problems from which we hope
I think that there is an inherent ease of reducing things down to very simple principles. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to get somebody to understand a lever, then you can do that by moving your elbow around and things, and there's a really close relationship to that. And you see that in particular in the science museums. Anything that can be reduced down to a simple bit of physics, there's things galore. There's very few things that really well explore systems thinking. In fact, I was thinking when you're talking about the systems of flood dynamics in the Nemo Museum in Amsterdam, there's an absolutely fantastic tabletop augmented reality flood control system, and it's projected down onto a tabletop, and you move these little bags around to build up the dikes, and you can also set up pumping stations. And if you can dry out an area, first eventually a farm will appear, and then if you keep it dry for a long time, you know, more and more human infrastructure will appear there. But it's quite a big table, and so there's 10, 15 kids all doing the same thing. But as they are like drying out their bit, they're just pumping the water into somebody else's bit. And it was a really, really nice example of the complexity of that system. I've been trying to think, since I saw that, what would be a New Zealand equivalent? Maybe the Manawatu's a direct copy would do it, but what could we do to get people thinking in that consequences way, what you do affects other people?
Yeah.
Can you think, are there some models we could explore for that?
I'm not sure that it's a model. I think it is a toolkit of models. I don't believe in one model fixes all.
Mm-hmm.
You have to understand when to use what tool. And I do believe there's a whole lot out there that is underused and under talked about. Models are powerful tools, and whole careers again are at stake. And then it becomes often my model against your model type of things rather than putting them together. I think we really have to start looking for the system of systems and all the characteristics of the various tools that are out there. And there are initiatives that do that. I'm, for example, part of IPBES, the Intergovernmental Platform for Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services. One of the groups I work with is on modeling and scenarios. And there we do exactly that. We look at how can we create a system of systems, what's already out there, and how do we think about those decision-making tools differently. And that does take into account how does it support participatory collaborative processes in its simple form, all the way to the more advanced decision support frameworks. Does that answer your question? I have a sense that it didn't.
It answered a different question extremely well. I was just thinking more, you know, if we just think about it in the museum sense, the how do we engage people in thinking about systems? What are some good ways of getting people to understand complexity and scaling and so on?
Well, you mentioned a good one, and that makes me think of games. Kids play a lot of games, and the computer games are out there all over. And I know of some initiatives where people are trying to build games that highlight more of that type of thinking. SimCity is one, for example. My kids, I see them play it sometimes, and if you build things in one place, things go haywire somewhere else. And you have to have that balance and these computer games on how to do spatial planning and spatial design allow them to think more as a whole system and sort of look at that if they do something here, it has a consequence somewhere else. And so I think there is hope in the fact that we're creating a new generation that is able to think more along those in an interconnected way. Now, I prefer them to use it on SimCity than some violent whatever game, but that's another story.
One of my favorite definitions of sustainability is ethics expanded in space and time. So there's a few questions embedded in there for me. And one of them is, what's the relationship between ecological economics and ethics?
Ethics, look, as I said, ecological economics is a transdisciplinary field of inquiry. It doesn't want to be a discipline. It's not prescriptive. It has a normative goal of sustainability, and anything goes in between there. It's about how do we create better tools. Ethics, in my view, comes in through first that normative goal of sustainable development. And as a conversation, ethics is, you can recognize it in the fairness of distribution as one of the pillars of ecological economics. And it's part of the conversation. When it comes to ethics, I think values and values you can recognize in many different ways, from individual to community to global, but also the non-anthropocentric type of values that people talk about more and more. Yeah, if you take humans out of the equation, then what happens?
Okay, the second question then is about space.
Yeah.
And space rears its head in several ways. One of them is the actual scaling effects about whether these models scale. But there's also the different spaces. The decisions that I'm making affect people in Cambodia.
Yeah.
Or the decisions we're all making cumulatively affect people in Cambodia or wherever else it might be. So how does ecological economics deal with scale?
Look, again, I want to get away a little bit from ecological economics in itself. One of the approaches that is quite popular within the ecological economics network is ecosystem services. Yeah, again, the benefits that people derive from ecosystems. Now, there's almost an archetypical list of about 20 of them, and they start with the provisioning services, food, fiber, and those things, the regulating services, flood protection, pollination, water provision, climate, gas regulation, and then you have the supporting services and the cultural services, spiritual, recreation, education, things like that. So there's, in whatever incarnation, a list of these ecosystem services, and some you can recognize on a very local scale, and some, like gas regulation, are very global. And so that, to me, is a bit of a multi-scale organizing principle where you can, any issue that is at stake, you can enter through one of the ecosystem services. And then it if you use that as an organizing principle, you very quickly go like, oh, it's not just about gas regulation, it's also about food provision, it's also about cultural aspects. You know, there's a whole lot of other things to think about in whatever you do. Does that make sense?
It does make sense.
Okay, so that's one tool, again, one approach. And then, of course, changes over time. I think that people in the ecological economics network are very concerned about time, future generations, and especially, for example, the discount rate. How we make decisions. The discount rate is extremely important. We have, I believe here in New Zealand, a prescribed discount rate for projects of about 8%. That's fairly high. That means, in effect, that you shift your preference for consumption away from the future and to the now. It means that if you think about a project and you want to invest in a project, you want a fast payback of your investment with a high discount rate. Yeah. And so that confines the way you can think about a project and the benefits, the other benefits it might generate. And so you see in the ecological economics networks and beyond, arguments for multiple discount rates for the right purposes, or even negative discount rates. Sometimes we simply have to invest in natural capital in order to have make it so that future generations have those benefits from ecosystems.
Is intergenerational equity explicitly considered?
I mean, explicitly, we don't have an ecological economics manual in that that sense. But yes, I think that the social ecological transitioning is the intergenerational aspect of it is, you do see that being important in this network.
You said that it's a normative, does have a normative goal, and I said that that was my favourite definition of sustainability. It's not anymore because I've changed in the last month or so, having visited Stockholm. And what people are talking about there is social ecological transformation.
Yeah.
As the way to actually explain sustainability.
So you went to the Stockholm Resilience.
I did.
Yeah. I know them quite well.
And I think it's a really good thing that they're taking the explicit economics out of the model, out of that statement, and so economics is a means to achieve this transformation. As an economist, is that a good...
I think so. I think value in... Look, as an economist, I'm pretty much the antichrist to the economist. So, value is a very broad, broad definition. I think many people confuse value with price. Yeah, they think if we talk about value, it is something that you can put a monetary value on. It's not. We use values in many different ways. To measure things, for example, to express what we care about, what's important to us, the ethical aspect of it. I will say I value my children, but they're not for sale to the highest bidder, right? My kidneys, I value my kidneys. I have no intention of selling them. But for some reason, when we look at wetlands, which function as the kidneys of our ecosystem, they are for sale. So there's something wrong there. Yeah, you can take out... I think it's both. Sometimes putting a monetary value on things is a good conversation starter, can be a good conversation starter. Again, it doesn't mean that we then immediately have to create a market for it. Yeah, we wrote a paper in 97, the global value of ecosystem services. And in it, we roughly came up with a huge number of 33 trillion per year in value. They actually mislabeled it price on the cover, but in value. And that was twice as much as global GDP at that point in time. So everybody set up, and it was a conversation starter. Does it mean then that we propose to put it up for sale? No, not at all. In the same article, we say, okay, conservatively estimated, it's very easy to come up with the 33 trillion, but in effect, it is unpriceable. You shouldn't be pricing it. Not pricing it, which is again different than valuing it. So if we can get that lingo straight, value versus price, that would go a long way. And I think that has to do with the difference between exchange value and use value. For example, we need water from an ecosystem and we use that all the time, but we don't pay a lot of money for it. But at the same time, in exchange of say diamonds, we are prepared to pay a huge amount of money for it. And so the difference between use value and exchange value, I think, is really important in that.
I interviewed Hans Brunix, the director of the European Environment Agency, when I was in Europe. And he had me cheering because he described the any pillars model of sustainability as intellectual nonsense.
Okay.
I've for a long time have rallied against the Venn diagram version of sustainability because of our tendency to split it apart and start talking about environmental sustainability or economic sustainability. For me, it's a nonsense because it's the integration of those things that makes it sustainable. Do you have a go-to definition of sustainability when you're introducing it to a group of first-year students or something?
Not really. I think it's a discourse that has happened over, since Brundtland, especially, that has an underlying worldview. That's where I'm kind of interested in the underlying worldview to it, of we should pay attention to doing this differently, all the way to the recent sustainable development goals that have recently been accepted, yes? And that gives you a bit of a dashboard of things we should be thinking about. And yeah, there's lots of initiatives that hang under that. But as you were saying, it's more about how do we connect those dots in particular situations. And we really have to start training that in our young people, hopefully in our decision makers now, if it's not too late. Even in sustainable development, the fragmented approach isn't really helping. So I'm all for synthesis. You know, provide the space, put people together, and they can come up with quite good ideas.
So Shane and I are writing a book proposal about these interviews, which we're calling Tomorrow's Heroes. Did you hear that, Shane? We're writing a book proposal.
Proposal.
That's easy. The book itself will be harder.
No, we've actually done more of the book writing than we have of the actual proposal.
Okay.
Anyway, so it explores... It explores the work that people are doing in terms of, you know, heroes, not trying to put people on pedestals, because that's kind of the point, is that everybody has these things. So what we're trying to do is to identify people by having superpowers, sustainable superpowers.
Oh, gosh.
So now I'm going to ask you, what would you like your sustainable superpower to be? And you can't have invisibility, and you can't run faster than a train.
Can you have time travel?
What would you do with time travel?
With time travel, I would create a vision for the future, in the future. And I would then use backcasting in thinking about how did we actually get there? How did we get to that desirable outcome? And backcast and see what did we need to do in order to get there. And so it's that type of leadership that I'm trying to encourage in the approaches and the tools that we're doing as well. So rather than looking at the past and extrapolating incrementally, I will go to the future backcast and create the scenarios and the pathways toward that.
So you like the best superpowers, best sustainable superpowers, is that they don't actually require magic.
Mm.
That is something we can do. We have those.
Yes,
we have those
we
structures
can.
To do, have that way of thinking.
And we have the tools. That's the beauty of living in this day and age. We have the ability, the computing abilities, the technologies to make so much of what we're capable of doing visible, and then bringing people together to make better decisions about it. Now, what we do have to crack is, of course, silly measures like GDP, but also intellectual property arrangements, what we call IP for public entities, and how we deal with the public property rights, but more so the common property rights. I mean, you can imagine ecosystems have rights to exist and function in themselves. And in fact, where New Zealand has a great example here in the Whanganui River, where the rights to the river, to the Whanganui River, are attributed. Vermont has a similar arrangement about its water bodies, including groundwater. And that, to me, if we start querying different ways of looking at property rights, that would help a lot too.
What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
I'd say working with Maori. That more holistic way of looking at the world, a different way of looking at the world. I find that very creative and giving, and gives ground for a dialogue that is very easy for me to have, very giving, very exciting, often, not always. I mean, not every Maori by definition is a kaitiaki. And there's a whole variation. I don't want to overblow. But yeah, that's, I think, in building those relationships, in thinking differently, I think we have made quite good progress in designing that toolkit we have. And other than that, I think the conversations I'm having abroad are quite powerful, that are sometimes easier to have than in New Zealand. So, yeah, if I look at it, the really local ones with Māori and the international ones is where it has worked easiest.
What motivates you?
To get up in the morning and face the, well, you have to acknowledge that the trends aren't good. And then quickly, I mean, I'm not in denial about this, but I choose to wake up every morning and work towards solutions because I enjoy that the most.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Quite active. Does that make me an activist? I'm probably sometimes. Sometimes I do show up on things, and I still bang my fist on a table. Most of the time, my natural tendency is that of a mediator, of a facilitator, and I would like to think of someone who provides that visionary and participatory leadership, and then invites people into that space.
What challenges are you looking forward to in the next couple of years?
Yeah, so one idea is to establish a synthesis center. So it's a place where people, scientists, can come together with practitioners as well, and really think about the good ideas. So it's not to get funding, it's just to get a good idea and work on it together for a short period of time and then make it come alive, which is very different than analysis. And so that is one of the initiatives I'm working on at the moment, and I'm quite excited about. I think there's a definite need in New Zealand. Other countries have had synthesis centers quite successfully, and so based on that experience over, say, the last 20 years, they have really demonstrated big impact of synthesis type of research, to the tune that rather than it's being funded by the tax dollar, philanthropists have stepped in and funded those activities.
If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur, what would it be?
That we really start to understand how dependent we are on those ecosystems, and that there is great opportunity and excitement in redesigning our human society and civilization to respect and stay within those bounds. And that to me is very exciting, actually.
Lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Keep at it. Just keep at it. I mean, find the right people. Don't be in denial about it. Find the right people and be courageous and keep at it. Especially young people.
Thank you very much for joining me.
You're welcome.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio.
If
You've been listening to Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. We broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz, and podcast on sustainablelens.org. On sustainablelens.org, we are building up a searchable archive of conversations with people from many different fields who are applying their skills to a sustainable future. In our conversations, we try to find out what motivates them and what it means to see the world through a sustainable perspective, through their sustainable lens. Tonight's sustainable lens was that of Associate Professor Marion Vandenbelt of Massey University. You can follow the links on sustainablelens.org to find us on Facebook and various other places. You can listen to Sustainable Lens via iTunes for free. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann. I hope you enjoyed the show.